It's Thursday, April 3rd, 2025, and I call this meeting of the Senate Elections Committee to order. And we do have a quorum. Today we have two items on the agenda. The first is a rather simple bill that has my name on it, and it's really a vehicle bill. It's SF-3097, and this is something that we just will send to the floor. And I believe we have to do a vote on it to send it to the floor. So in the hearing notice, you'll see that this is my bill. It's just simply a vehicle bill that we're going to send to the floor in case it's needed later in the session. We're not taking any testimony on it. Any member discussion on this shadow bill? If not, Senator Westland moves that Senate File 3097 will be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. The motion is passed. Next, we have Senator Westland, who is going to present the Senate Elections Policy Bill. And this is Senate File 2384. We'll be laying the bill over, and there's many things that we have to do to it yet. And you may be surprised to see that Senator Westland is presenting the bill, and actually, I think you could probably say that most of the contents of this bill was due to Senator Westland's heavy work here. So she's been very prolific in getting all of these legal issues taken care of, and so it is appropriate for her to carry this bill. So since 2023, we've led this committee as a team, and I've decided that several times I want to give the vice chair the opportunity to carry the omnibus bill. We need to invest in growth of the next generation of leaders, and Senator Westland is one of those people. So Senator Westland, please, if you want to do any introduction, you could do that now.
Thank you, Senator Carlson. And I actually would just start with saying thank you for your generosity in allowing me to carry the bill. And I will just say in our mutual, Admiration Society, that I have appreciated working with you. And I thank you for the opportunity, and I hope I do you proud. So this is Senate File 2384. And this is going to be our omnibus policy bill. As Americans and Minnesotans, we all, regardless of where we live, what we look like, or our political persuasion, have a right to know that our leaders are making decisions in the public interest and protecting the people against bad actors. This requires transparency as to the financial interests of our leaders, who they are listening to, and who is speaking in our elections. Transparency builds faith in government. This is the fundamental principle behind the 2025 Elections Policy Omnibus Bill, and it includes a wide range of pro-democracy reforms that will help improve transparency, prevent corruption and fraud, close loopholes in our campaign finance laws, and strengthen election administration across the state. I'm looking forward to hearing testimony about the bill today, and then marking it up at our next hearing. And with that, Mr. Chair, I am going to ask Ms. Stengel to do a walkthrough of the bill so that everyone will be familiar with its contents.
Ms. Stengel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, and members. I'll go through each section and let members know what bill it came from and a brief description, and happy to answer questions at the end. Starting on page one of the A8 amendment, sections 1 through 3 come from Senator Marty's Senate File 2386. This was his bill about inaugural and transition expenses. These three sections provide for transition expenses for the Secretary of State-elect, Attorney General-elect, and State Auditor-elect. Moving to section 4 on page 3, this came from a Senator Marty bill, Senate File 1996. And amends the definition of expressly advocates by changing the word advocating to advocates. On page 4, section 5, this comes from Senator Westland's 2562, and this is what I'll call the Board Rex bill that included all of the provisions from the Campaign Finance Board recommendations for the year. And section 5 provides a definition of expert witness for the Chapter 10A. Section 6 comes from Senator Marty's 1996 and amends the definition of independent expenditure. Section 7 on the bottom of page 4 comes from the Board Rec Bill and modifies the definition of lobbyist in several ways. That carries through to page 6. Section 8 comes from the Board Rec Bill and modifies the definition of metropolitan government unit. On the top of page 9 is another provision from Senator Marty's inaugural expense and transition expense bills and provides that these expenses are non-campaign disbursements. This carries over to page 9. Section 10 comes from Senator Westland's Board Rec Bill, and this removes several people from the definition of public official, and you can see those people on page 10. On page 11, section 11 is another Board Rec provision. This provides a lobbyist and designated lobbyist must report certain expert witness communications. On page 12, section 12, this is Senator Westland's Senate File 2021 and requires the board to do a handbook for lobbying that's written in plain language. Section 13 on page 13 comes from the Board Rec Bill, requires local officials and political subdivisions with populations over 50,000 in the metro area to disclose their potential conflicts of interest. The bottom of that same page is another Board Rec. It's a conforming change to the previous section. On page 14, section 15 is another Board Rec that has elected local officials must disclose certain representation of clients. The very bottom of page 14 is section 16. This comes from a combination of two bills, both Senator Marty's 1996 and Senator Westland's 2562, three bills, and Senator Swadzinski's 2412. This amends the time for filing economic interest statements and also requires additional people to file these statements. And you'll see at the top of page 15, the timeline changes in the additional people. Starting partway down page 15 with section 17, this comes from Senator Dreheim's 1259 and Westland's 2768. This amends the economic interest statement to require people to disclose virtual currency and to report transactions about virtual currency and stock options. On page 17, section 18, this is a board rec. It strikes the reference to metropolitan government units. You'll see that throughout in several places. And it requires, which means that this section now applies to all local officials, and this is about statements of economic interest. On the next page, page 18, is another board rec, and it specifies where certain people file their statements of economic interest. Section 20 is another provision from Senator Marty's inaugural and transition expense bill. On page 19, section 21 comes from Senator Marty's 1996, defines disbursements for chapter 10A. For the next several sections are all from the same bill. 22 amends what constitutes a coordinated expenditure. That takes us to page 22. Section 23 from the same bill amends what constitutes a non-coordinated expenditure. On page 23, section 24 requires reporting on personal contributions to campaigns. Section 25 amends the definition of electioneering communication. On page 24, section 26 provides a cross-reference to a new section that specifies the disclaimer for electioneering communications. Section 27 is a combination of two bills heard by the committee, Senator Westland's 1854 and Senator Putnam's 863, that amended the same section, so they are combined here. This has to do with reprisals being prohibited from becoming a candidate for elected public office and for refusing to communicate with officials. On page 26, section 28 comes from Senator Westland's 1662. This codifies a campaign finance board rule on major decisions of non-elected local officials. At the bottom of page 26, section 29, comes from Senator Swadzinski's 2412, and it makes a conforming change in some of the school board chapters, just specifying that statements of economic interest apply to members of charter school boards. On page 27, Section 30 comes from Senator Marty's 1996 and requires local campaign, it's a local campaign report clarification. And the next section is also about local campaign reports and requires them to include email addresses. On the next page from the same bill, it makes some changes to disclaimers on campaign material. On the following page, section 33 makes modifications to independent expenditure disclaimers. Section 34 provides new language, specifically providing disclaimers for electioneering communications. On page 30, section 35 comes from Senator Marty's 1996 and Senator Gustafson's 2236 and makes changes to disclaimers on electronic communications and strikes a reference to a statute that's being repealed. Section 36 is also from Senator Marty's 1996 and is about disclosures on signs. Section 37 on the top of page 31 is Senator Westland's 1851 and has to do with misrepresentation of campaign authority. Section 38 at the bottom of the page comes from Senator Curran's bill that was the MACO administration bill. And this has the requirements for mailing absentee ballot applications and sample ballots. On the bottom of page 32, Senator Westland's 1812, expanding election-related bribery provisions. On page 33, section 40, is Senator Westland's 1851, having to do, this relates to the earlier provision on misrepresentation of campaign authority, and this is about the enforcement of that provision. On the next page, 34, sections 41 and 42 are both from Senator Gustafson's 2236 and strike references to a section that's being repealed. Section 43 is a new provision that relates to Special School District Number 1 in Minneapolis and provides the deadline for filing the economic interest statement is 14 days after the close of the filing period instead of 14 days after the person files their affidavit of candidacy to make it a uniform deadline. On the top of page 35, section 44, Senator Bolden's 1915, which requires the board to study campaign spending limits. On that same page, section 45, is Senator Marty's 2386, which requires the board to amend a rule about transition expenses to conform to the earlier provisions in the bill. The repealer is also from Senator Marty's bill, 1996, and the Senator Gustafson, 2236. And those three have to do with disclaimers on websites, and the 211B, 06, and 08 are two statutes that were found to be unconstitutional. Paragraph B of the repealer is from the Marty 1996. It has to do with disclaimers on broadcast and social media. And paragraph C is Senator Westland's 1662 about major decisions of non-elected local officials that was codified earlier in the bill. And then finally, section 47 is a default effective date of January 1st, 2026, unless otherwise provided. Article 2 is all of the election policy. The first comes from Senator Westland's 2384, which I'll just call the OSS admin bill. This has to do with residential facilities not providing lists of employees, but instead employees providing proof that they're employees when they vouch for residents when they vote. On page 38, section 2 is from the same bill and has to do with additional proofs of residency for students. Section 3, also from the OSS bill, removes permanent absentee voter list box from the voter registration form, and that's replaced with something on the absentee ballot application. Section 4 on the bottom of page 40 comes from Senator Curran's MACO administration bill, and this has to do with voter lists being provided with, that's not the MACO bill. This is just a Senator Curran bill, 2488. This requires the Secretary of State or the county auditor to provide the public voter information list within 5 days of receiving a completed request instead of within 10 days. Section 5 at the top of page 41 is from Senate File 2232, which is the MACO bill. And this has to do with e-poll books and combined polling places. Section 6 on page 42 was both in the OSS and the MACO bill and makes various changes to absentee ballot applications, timelines, procedures and the application itself. On page 44, section 7 comes from the OSS bill. This has to do with polling places for absentee voting or early voting. Section 8 on page 45, also from the OSS bill. And section 9 makes some changes to properly refer to absentee ballot envelopes. Section 10 on page 46 comes from Senate File 600, which is a Senator Cran bill and the OSS bill, and provides notice of temporary polling places and allows for temporary polling places on off-reservation tribal lands. Section 11 is from the MACO bill and talks about health care facility absentee voting. On page 48, section 12 is from the MACO bill and provides that political party balance is not required for county elections not held in conjunction with state elections. Section 13 at the bottom of that page is from the OSS bill, changes an envelope name, and talks about handling cross-checking and retention of absentee ballot envelopes. On page 49, section 14, from the OSS bill, and it has to do with storing and counting absentee ballots. Section 15 on page 50, also from the OSS bill, strikes a reference to a deadline that has passed. Section 16 is from the MACO bill, has to do with the responsibility for UOCAVA ballots. Section 17 on page 52 and section 18 provide that the deadlines for absentee ballots in the earlier section don't apply to emergency responders or voters with a disability. Section 19 from the OSS bill has to do with processing absentee ballots and what must be done each day. Section 20 on page 53 is from the MACO bill and has to do with pronunciation of candidate names and what candidates have to do when they file their affidavits of candidacy to get their names pronounced correctly by the default technology for the assisted voting technology. Page 54, section 21 from the OSS bill requires judges, county attorneys, and sheriffs to provide certain information and provides requirements if bills are used for proof of residence. Section 22 on 55 from the OSS bill requires candidates for president or vice president to submit affidavits of candidacy that include certain information. Page 56, section 23 from the OSS bill, again, has to do with bills for showing residency when filing for office, this time for absent candidates. Section 24 from the OSS bill requires the filing officer to notify the person who prepares ballots of the names of candidates or changes to those names. Section 25 is from the MACO bill. This is on page 57. It makes a timeline change to the request for write-in votes to be counted. On page 58, section 26 is from the MACO bill. It has to do with combined polling places and e-poll books. On page 60, section 27 is from the OSS bill. It has to do with municipal boundary adjustments being effective depending on the date that when municipal boundary adjustments become effective, depending on when the election happens. Section 28 on page 61 is a Senator Bolden bill, 2846, that has to do with the notice of change polling places and requiring those notices to be in non-English languages. At the polling place has to provide materials in non-English languages. Section 29 is a new section but relates to the previous section. Notices when a polling place changes the same day because of an emergency, those notices need to be in non-English languages if the polling places provide materials in non-English languages. On page 62, section 30, this is a provision from the OSS bill about developing and following chain of custody plans. On page 63, section 31, it's an OSS provision that makes changes to the election judge party lists. On the top of page 64, section 32 is a related change to appointing election judges from the list and requiring exhaustion of those election judge party lists. On page 65, section 33 from the OSS bill, it amends the election judge oath to reference specifically section 211B075. On page 66, section 34 from the OSS bill removes the exemption that allows untrained election judges to serve in very small precincts. Section 35 from the OSS bill has to do with the election reporting system maintained and operated by the Secretary of State. Section 36 on page 67 is from the MACO bill. This allows municipal clerks more time to secure supplies from county auditors. Section 37 on page 68 is from the OSS bill. It makes various modifications to the errors and omissions process. On page 70, section 38 is both from the OSS and MACO bills. It amends timelines for mail ballots and provides an exemption for election judge party balance requirements if county elections are not held with state elections. Section 39 on page 71 is from the OSS bill. It amends the voter bill of rights to conform to a consent decree and changes. This is a change consistent with other changes made in previous years, so this is just sort of a cleanup provision. Section 40 on page 72 is from the OSS bill that allows election judges to sign either side of the ballot, not just the back. Section 41 on the top of page 73 provides that the polling place roster needs to reference the location of residence, not just where the person maintains residence. This is consistent with some changes that were made in the last couple years. Page 74, section 42 is from the MACO bill. Similar to an earlier section, this one requires the municipal clerk to notify the person who prepares ballots of candidate names and any changes. Section 43 from the OSS bill amends the filing period for municipal elections without a primary. Section 44 on page 75 is from the OSS bill and makes some changes to the city canvassing board and what they must do. Section 45 is from the MACO bill. This says that the school district clerk notifies a person preparing ballots of candidate names and any changes. On page 76, section 46 is from the MACO bill and amends timeline for affidavits of candidacy for school districts. Section 47 is from the OSS bill and makes changes to the school board canvassing provisions. Section 48 on 77 is from the OSS bill and has to do with mail voting at polling places. Section 49 is from Senator Coran, Senate File 2489, and has to do with testing a voting system. It requires 5 days' notice of public testing of equipment. It deletes some obsolete language and specifies that tests must be for each question in the contest. Section 50 on page 78 is from the OSS bill, and it removes some obsolete language on ballots related to town elections. Section 51 is from the OSS and is about a timeline calling for special county elections. Section 52 on page 80 is from the OSS bill and has to do with the election of municipal officers after incorporation or consolidation and requires those to be on uniform election dates. Section 53 is from both the OSS and the MACO bills, has to do with filing periods for hospital district elections and hospital district canvassing boards. On 81, section 54 is a new section, but it relates to the OSS bill and allows for transition to new voter registration and absentee ballot applications relating to the changes about permanent absentee voting. And then finally, on the last page, page 82, there's a repealer of a statute related to a township election study that was done in 2016 and inspections of ballots after a contest has been instituted. Those are both from the OSS bill. And the default effective date of this section is July 1, 2025. But as you look through the article, there are a variety of effective dates for various sections.
Thank you. Thank you, Council Stengel. Senator Westland, would you like to go to your testifiers?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It looks like we have a number of folks. I guess we would start with Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. Please state your name and who you're representing, and proceed with your testimony.
All right. Thank you, Chair Carlson. My name is Nicole Freeman at the Office of the Secretary, the Office of Minnesota Secretary of State. There we go. Thank you to Senator Westland and the committee for this bill. I really appreciated working with the committee and local election administrators on many of these provisions. So the bill, I think, really brings forward some great ideas that support local election administrators and the work that they do. It also furthers the balance of access for voters and the need for election security. Finally, it makes a number of technical adjustments so that statute is more uniform and also up to date. Some of the election administration improvements that I wanted to highlight. The first one being that it removes the permanent absentee application from the voter registration app and allows the Office of the Secretary of State, not allows, requires the office to instead put that on the absentee ballot application. That was coming from feedback from local administrators, and I think will really help voters understand what they're signing up for on that permanent absentee application, and also make sure that all of the required ID numbers are captured so ballots can be appropriately accepted. Thank you also for adding clarifying steps that ballot boards must take when they're opening signature and ballot envelopes. I think that that clarification and statewide standard will be really useful. The section also makes it clear, really crystal clear, that ballot envelopes have to be retained. Section 16 allows flexibility for local jurisdictions when handling UOCAVA ballots. That was a MACO provision. And I think that the office feels like it will provide some efficiencies when processing these ballots and also hopefully help on election day with one less trip that election administrators have to coordinate. Several provisions are also related to candidate filing. And we appreciate the clarifications around ensuring which bills are valid, the due dates of bills are valid when candidate filings occur. Also making it clear that if someone submits a ballot, if someone submits their candidate filing affidavit electronically because they're away, or they might submit it by mail, that any of those documents that might have sensitive data on them, that they're considered private. We also appreciate the inclusion of the errors and omissions out-of-court remedy. We talked about that here in committee and also last week at Judiciary, but this will really allow local administrators to work with impacted candidates to correct any ballot errors that might be found and resolve them quickly and get those corrected ballots out to voters. Importantly, I think this remedy will hopefully save county attorney and district court time. We know their time can be spent on more pressing matters, and so we're excited about this efficiency. We also really appreciate the inclusion of the subpoint that we hope will incentivize a candidate to come to the table and come to an agreement or potentially face having to pay court fees. We think that that is a little bit of an incentive to get folks to come to the table, come to a sensible agreement when the situation warrants it, right? And I think it's important to remember that a judge can only require these fees to be paid by a losing party if the individual's argument wasn't reasonable or if it would not, and so long as it doesn't cause an undue burden. So we're really hoping that this mechanism will help reduce the likelihood of a candidate trying to use an error unfairly to their advantage and then cause the whole situation to have to go to court, causing unnecessary delay. We also are also in this category of election administration improvements. I think the clarifications made to the election judge party lists, both receiving the list sooner from the parties, as well as providing clarity as to what exhausting the list means, will help local administrators use those lists more effectively, get people assigned to their roles on time, and help with the participation there. Now on to a couple of voter access and security provisions. The office really appreciates the formalization of the chain of custody plans. We know that right now, counties and cities, townships, school districts, they're all doing this planning in the background. They're all thinking through these things. But this formalization of it really empowers both our office to offer guidance and promotes those discussions amongst local election officials as the plans are updated ahead of each statewide election. Two more items I want to highlight. The codification of the election night reporting system. I want to thank Senate Counsel for that, as well as the committee. I think it will be really helpful to put that in statute, and some of those, put it in statute that it needs to happen. We're also excited about the inclusion of unofficial results report testing, and requiring that counties complete that before each election, again, helping election night go smoother. Also included sort of under that category, I think, are the MACO provisions that require local jurisdictions to share their candidate filings with the county on a timely basis. And I think this will assist the county in that data entry of candidate filings, as well as improve public accessibility to candidate filing information, as well as aid in the ballot creation process to help speed that up. And finally, we are particularly supportive of the requirement that mail ballots in mail ballot jurisdictions need to be sent out at least 28 days prior to Election Day. We think that this will ensure that voters will have time to receive, review, and then send back their ballots, particularly given the fluctuating USPS timelines. So thank you so much. Happy to continue conversations with any members as you might wish, and thanks for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. Senator Westlin, please introduce your next testifier.
I don't know that these are necessarily always all people testifying for my bill, but just people who signed up to testify.
Okay.
Just to be clear. But I'd love them if they all testify in favor of the bill. I believe up next is Matt Hilgard.
That's right.
So, Mr. Hilgard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Counties, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Appreciate that. Members of the committee, my name is Matt Hilgart. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. I want to thank the author, the chair, Senate staff, and Senate counsel, as well as the Secretary of State's office, in particular Nicole Freeman, and members of this committee for their engagement with locals on this bill this session. I will say that there's been a lot of great, sensible, reasonable, and bipartisan proposals that are in this bill, and there's also a lot of technical provisions that are in this bill, very nuanced technical issues, and I have appreciated throughout the entire process all the committee's involvement of local of elected officials in those conversations, even when we're not 100% in agreement. So thank you right off the bat for that. One of the technical issues we're hoping receives a little bit more conversation is, of course, that bill that we just heard last week regarding economic interest statements. I thought it was a very great conversation that we had with Chief Author Senator Swazinski regarding this bill. As a reminder, counties already do these economic interest statements for all their county commissioners. This bill would expand the scope, especially as the definition of local official and the staff outside the metro area that would be doing these, and we'd really like to talk about whether the word recommend is something that we could look at in changing so that these economic interest statements are really just meant for those who are actually making budgetary decisions, not everyone under all departments, et cetera. I am particularly excited about the inclusion of the absentee ballot application mailer disclaimer. I believe that was a Senator Curran bill this year. It's been authored by others in years past, but I think that's just good public policy. It's for transparency's sake. When folks are receiving these applications in the mail, they're not just calling their county folks and saying, why are you sending me ballots? Well, one, they're not ballots, but also they're not official government correspondents. And so we are delighted to see this in here. It's a good public policy thing. It will be stating that this is not official government correspondence, and it will not be pre-filling information on those applications. And that's the other critical component, because our staff are spending a lot of time and resources trying to correct stuff that is not correctly pre-filled. So this is a great provision, and I'm very grateful for it. Lastly, I want to just thank this committee for their patience and time in supporting the proposals of the MACO kind of bill, as it was referenced in Article 2, and that is the 12 provisions that MACO officials brought forward this year, authored by Senator Curran, but I know those officials met with a lot of you in your offices, and I appreciate you not dozing off, too, because these are really technical issues, but they are issues that really help our county administrators, our city election administrators, taxpayers administer good, sound elections. We really appreciate it. I will say, I've seen of late that I know there's some interest in potentially talking further about the deadlines for submitting absentee ballots online, applications online. I would just say tread carefully. This is one where I think at the core here of our interest in actually saying no more than seven, or this bill has 5 days before, is that we don't, this is all about setting correct expectations. If folks are actually sending in these applications and they're not going to be able to receive them, their ballots in the mail in the proper time, as Ms. Freeman alluded to, the volatility of USPS across the state is very different. And so while we would have appreciated the 7 day cutoff, I think five is nice and reasonable, and we appreciate you putting that in there. It is better than current law, but I think suggestions to go even further below are not realistic, especially if you take them at face value of across the state. So just, we appreciate the language that's in this bill, and if there's discussion to widen that or minimize it even further, we'd like to be a part of that. Mr. Chair, that is all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hilgard. Our next testifier is Michael Stahlberger from Blue Earth County and the Minnesota Association of County Officers, and he's via Zoom. So,
yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is Michael Stahlberger. I'm Property and Environmental Resources Director for Blue Earth County. We have about 40,000 registered voters, and as was mentioned today, I'm representing the Minnesota Association of County Officers. That is all 87 counties, auditors, treasurers, recorders, finance officers, and also the elections administrators. I want to continue what has already been said, expressing appreciation to Senators Chair Carlson, Senator Westland, also all the other committee members who worked on this bill, who listened to MACO as we presented our items, as this bill does include the provisions brought forward by MACO. We also want to thank the committee staff members and Senate Council for all the work helping us revise language and getting it just right or to a point off that you see it in the bill in front of you today. As has been described, many of MACO's provisions, in fact, all of our provisions in some form, have been included in Article 2. Before I get to Article 2, though, I want to draw your attention to Article 1, Section 38, which is what Mr. Hilgart was just describing with the absentee ballot application, mailing process, and also the mailing process for sample ballots. This is a provision that is really important to MACO's members. We heard time and time again of frustrations from voters where applications were pre-filled with incorrect information or sent in multiple instances, leading to their frustration and concern and even distrust of the election processes. That provision alone will make a significant change in the workload for elections administrators. As I move into Article 2, MACO does not have any significant election administrative concerns with the provisions included in that article. Some of our most, the article provisions that we are most supportive of, I'll draw your attention to, would be the election judge party affiliation list, the lists that are provided from our major parties. That provision, Section 31, will also make that process much more efficient, transparent, and understandable for the election judges who are offering to serve through their party affiliations. Ms. Freeman also mentioned Section 37 of Article 2, the errors and omissions clause. MACO strongly supports this provision as a way to get any ballot issues resolved timely so that we can continue the voting process and have as little impact on our voters as possible. And we also strongly support the changes to the late candidate filing period to also help us create ballots more timely and ensure their accuracy. As is already mentioned, this bill does include MACO's provisions, so I won't run through those. They are technical, they are administrative, and they are improvements. We are really supportive of the combined polling places, being able to use the e-rosters or the e-poll books. That is a time saver, a cost saver, and an efficiency process for our voters, a process improvement for our voters. The phonetic spelling of candidate names in Section 20 may sound super technical. It's not very exciting, but it's going to lead to better election day experiences for voters with disabilities, and we strongly support that. Section 30 of Article 2 is the chain of custody provisions. That is a provision that we've worked with the Secretary of State's office on. It is something that we support from a consistency perspective, and we look forward to continuing to work with the Secretary's office on how to build a template that can help reduce the added workload of documenting those processes that are in existence. It'll be a good change once we get there, and we'll continue to work through that. We do recognize that there is some concern, especially through a submitted a testimony letter with the absentee ballot application deadline that is being presented in Section 6. We've worked hard to craft a solution that works across the state and responds to the mailing timelines that exist for many of our voters in outstate Minnesota. But we'll continue to work on that. We're happy to continue the conversation to figure out what improvements can get us to a point that we can ensure voters understand when ballots may be received by them and that they have enough time to vote that ballot. Our ultimate goal with that provision is to make sure that a voter who wishes to vote can do so in a fashion that's efficient and effective for them. And we want to make sure that if that is the mailing process, that they can actually receive that ballot in time to vote it. Finally, we also recognize that there may have been an oversight in the way that we presented a change that allows counties to not have party affiliated election judges for the ballot board. Those are for special elections or standalone elections where it is a nonpartisan contest only. For example, county sheriff or county attorney. The bill allows counties to not have party affiliated judges on their ballot boards. We missed, unfortunately, including cities in that provision, and we would support the committee's consideration of that during markup. I'll close with a final thank you again for including these important provisions and also for your willingness to hear from us as we met with many of the committee members throughout the beginning part of session. It was really important for us to be able to present these items to you for your consideration, and we appreciate your willingness to listen to them. My last comment for you is that we really do pride ourselves as election administrators in making sure that our important work of ensuring every eligible voter who wishes to cast a ballot can do so in an election that is free, fair, secure, and accurate. We sincerely appreciate your committee's work to help us do our work. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stahlberger, and thank you for your commitment for free, fair, and accurate elections. Now we have Ms. Kathy Blazer from the Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. Please identify yourself for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members. I am Kathy Blazer, Co-Executive Director of Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. The First Amendment of our Constitution protects both our freedom of speech and our freedom to associate with others. And our courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, have consistently ruled that those two rights in conjunction prohibit a state from limiting the fundamental right of a nonprofit advocacy organization to comment on the votes, statements, or actions of public officials. The change to the definition of independent expenditure on page 4, lines 19 to 21, as well as to the definition of coordinated expenditures on page 19, lines 22 to 23, would directly violate those rights. Court case after court case has recognized that a group of citizens who freely associate as a nonprofit corporation like MCCL have an almost unlimited right to comment on the votes, statements, and actions of public officials. To limit that right by adding a definition of independent or coordinated expenditures that includes expression outside of express advocacy would gut that protection, and so would quickly be found unconstitutional. Now, supporters of that section might state that it doesn't limit our right to free speech. All we need to do is form an independent expenditure committee, which the state would allow to say and write the same content. But courts have repeatedly and consistently equated electioneering communication, which can be regulated, with express advocacy. When a communication is not express advocacy, as is the case here, with the very subjective words promotes, supports, attacks, such non-electioneering communication cannot, under our federal constitution, be regulated at the heightened level of political communication. In other words, the U.S. Supreme Court has found that a corporation is allowed to communicate in exactly these ways without using a political committee. This very point was made clear in the dicta of the 2012 Eighth Circuit Court case, MCCL v. Swanson, in which we prevailed on free speech grounds against another very restrictive Minnesota law attempting to deprive nonprofit advocacy groups of our rights to free speech. MCCL is resolved to continue to defend our rights to free speech and association, Any attempt to redefine what constitutes express advocacy would be an irresponsible expenditure of public funds, having little or no chance of ultimately being upheld in court. Case after case has resulted in the same outcome for those attempting to restrict corporate speech. We respectfully ask you to reject such unconstitutional and irresponsible action to limit the free speech of Minnesota citizens by removing lines 419 through 421 and lines 1922 through 1923. Please note that because of the tight timeline on providing written testimony on this bill, our written testimony does not refer to the changes required on page 19. That language remains nonetheless unconstitutional as written. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Blazer. Next testifier is Ms. Elizabeth Schimmick from the Campaign Legal Center, and this is via Zoom. Ms. Schimmick.
Chair Carlson and honorable members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Schimmick, and I'm senior legal counsel for campaign finance with Campaign Legal Center. CLC is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C., and dedicated to protecting and strengthening democracy through law at all levels of government. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 2384 today, particularly in support of the provisions incorporated from Senate File 1996. As I previously testified on that bill, voters have a right to know who's spending to influence their decisions when they cast their ballot. However, secret spending by wealthy special interests, sometimes called dark money, impedes that right, and these wealthy special interests continually seek new ways to hide their election spending from the public eye. My testimony today will focus on three policies adopted from that bill, which would update Minnesota's campaign finance system and address gaps that dark money spenders seek to exploit. First, the bill expands transparency requirements for independent expenditures beyond express advocacy to include paid communications that promote, attack, support, or oppose a candidate, often called PASO communications. Some major spenders attempt to skirt around express advocacy and influence elections while avoiding transparency, but still promote or attack a person's candidacy with those ads. By including PASO communications as independent expenditures, Minnesota would join states like Hawaii, Arizona, and Maine in ensuring that voters know more about who is spending big money to influence their votes. Second, this bill updates coordination statutes to address gaps in coverage and ensure that campaigns and outside spenders are not illegally coordinating their activity. These key updates include adding coordinated electioneering communications as a type of coordinated expenditure and addressing a practice called redboxing. Third, the bill modernizes Minnesota's on-ad disclaimer rules for digital ads, reflecting the prevalence of digital political spending by clarifying that digital political ads must have on-ad disclaimers unless it is technologically infeasible, and outlining the disclaimer format for electioneering communications. These changes will help to ensure that Minnesota voters have immediate and easy access to information regarding the spenders behind the election ads they see, wherever those ads find them, and it will help to deter corruption and the appearance of corruption in Minnesota's campaign finance system. Thank you very much for your time, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Ms. Schimmick. Very, very good information. Next testifier is Mary Hartnett from Clean Elections, Minnesota. Please identify yourself for the record and continue with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Hartnett, and I'm the Executive Director of Clean Elections, Minnesota, a nonpartisan nonprofit organization. It's focused on reducing the influence of money in politics, emphasizing the importance of public financing and limits on coordinated campaign practices to protect democracy. This bill makes great strides in doing just that. Thanks for all of your hard work. We're pleased to see the following provisions included in the omnibus bill. In Article 1, Section 12, the lobbying handbook will help everyone understand the rules of the road related to campaign finance and disclosure. Seasoned lobbyists and grassroots advocates will benefit from this roadmap. Section 16 through 17, Senator Westland's and Dryham's inclusion of cryptocurrency and stock in the Statement of Economic Interests, updates and strengthens disclosure requirements. Sections 26, 32 through 36, Senator Marty's bill, 1996, addresses the negative consequences of the 2010 U.S. Supreme Court ruling allowing corporations and political action committees to spend unlimited amounts of money in elections. This has led to the rise of dark money groups. Our strategic advisor, David Fisher, testified before this committee. If you read the Citizens United opinion of January 2010, you will find that 8 of the 9 justices of the U.S. Supreme Court expressed that these new moneyed free speech rights given to corporate entities can and should be accompanied by commensurate responsibilities of full transparency and disclosure. And 1996 just does that under the auspices of both the state constitution and the U.S. Supreme Court justices. This provision aims to reduce the influence of money in politics, close loopholes, increase transparency, and puts limits on coordinated campaign practices that are essential tools to ensure voting transparency and the viability of our democracy. It addresses the practice of red boxing, and additionally, the bill mandates that disclaimers be included on digital media ads, ensuring transparency by letting voters know who is behind online messages, similar to requirements for print and broadcast media. Section 29, Senator Swedzinski's bill to increase school boards and charter district administrators increases accountability. Senator Westland's bribery bill had bipartisan support and it protects election integrity. Paying voters for signatures creates the perception of vote buying, eroding trust in our system, and raising concerns about whether political decisions are being based on merit or financial incentives. It curbs wealthy influence and super PACs. Already distort our elections without action, we risk in creating new unchecked forms of campaign spending, one that allows deep-pocketed donors to influence voters outside of the candidates themselves. Section 44, Senator Bolden's campaign spending limit study is long overdue and helps set reasonable limits. And I wanted to throw in, as a long-term disability advocate, happy to see an Article 2, the reasonable accommodation for voters with disabilities provision. Last, we are disappointed Senator Port's Senate File 905 was not included, despite having bipartisan support. We will advocate in future sessions to expand the support this bill has across party lines to unravel the web of dark money through independent expenditures. Arizona voters passed a referendum that included similar language in their Voter Right to Know Act that gave voters the right to know the original source of all major contributions used to pay in whole or part for campaigns media spending. The law aims to provide voters with critical information about the financial influences shaping their decisions. Last, we would like to have seen Senator Carlson's Senate File 1071, the RC ranked choice voting bill. We believe offering viable alternatives to voters in the two-party system through ranked choice voting is an important election reform that should be on the table. Thank you for the hard work of this committee, and thanks for considering my testimony. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. Hartnett. Do we have any questions of the testifiers from the committee? Senator Bolden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Ms. Shimmick if she is still available. I see her there. Very good, thank you. I'm wondering, in your experience, what you are seeing across the country in terms of lawsuits in court cases in upholding the PASO standard.
Ms. Shimmick.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senator, we have seen lawsuits that deal with PASO standard or similar standards across the country over the last 15 years. The PASO standard has been upheld as a part of independent election spending subject to transparency requirements in the 1st, 2nd, 4th, and 9th circuits. And it is currently in effect in states including Arizona, Hawaii, Maine, Vermont, and West Virginia.
Thank you, Ms. Shimmick. Thank you, Senator Bolden. Any other questions of the testifiers? Any closing comments, Senator Westman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Look forward to us doing the hard work next week doing markup.
I think you've done a lot of the hard work, Ms. Westman, but we will meet again on Tuesday to discuss the bill and consider amendments. With that, everyone, thank you. Senator Grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Westland, I think we've got a bill that has, I think it's got plenty of good things in it. Some things we got to work on. It's got a little more balance. It's a little more bipartisan this year. So we look forward to, I still have some challenges. You know, I think some of the issues around the economic interest expansion, some of the broader exemptions around online ads and some things I think we still need more clarity on, and we'll look to have deeper conversations on Tuesday, I believe, for the markup. So I appreciate it's better. We got a little work to do on some other areas, but I appreciate it. Thank you, and so thank you, Senator Wesson.
And thank you, Senator Cran, for all the input that you've had here too. I've noticed that you have your name is mentioned a lot of times in contributions, so I appreciate that. Anyone else have comments or questions? With that, meeting adjourned.